The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly, the podcast broadcast to the end of the world, which may, of course, be sooner than we think. I'm Alex Kratosky, and with all luck, I'll still be Alex Kratosky next week, provided I'm not turned into a bowl of petunias when the Large Hadron Collider is switched on. Joining me in the pod of technological surrealism are our two resident masters of megabytes, Jemima Kish and Charles Arthur. Welcome to you both. If you had a choice, what would you turn into, Jemima? Stammering
version of me that didn't stammer. Yeah, I don't know.
A bear,
a big bear.
Yeah,
roar.
One of those grisly ones that eats people and stuff.
Not the ones that get shot by Sarah Palin.
No, definitely not. In fact, I'd
That's
come back
a moose.
And eat Sarah Palin.
Yeah, a moose disguised as a bear.
There we go.
Yeah.
All political views are welcome on this podcast, Charles.
We've been watching The Incredibles again at home, and I think I'd like to be Mr. Incredible because he's pretty incredible.
Indeed.
But by the way, did you know that the LHC they have their own Twitter-like service for all the particle physicists? It's called Splitter.
Oh, here we go. You had this meme, when was it, on last Friday or something like that? You were asking the Twitterverse about the various...
Absolutely. Yeah.
You've got an evil glint in your eye. I think we're going to be hearing more about this later. Jemima, you've been playing around with some
stuff.
New technology this
Well,
week.
I don't know if a wormery counts as new technology, but...
It's pretty old technology, to be fair.
24 of my worms have escaped and died on the bathroom floor, which is not great.
What did you do?
Well, somebody on Twitter advised, put a weight on the lid, which is kind of obvious, really. But no, what I was looking for is some decent transcription software that doesn't rely on paying somebody in India sort of 5p a day to do it. So if anyone has any recommendations...
Yes, please do let us know, because I'm always interested in that as well.
Yes.
Anyway, on this week's show, we're returning to Earth with coverage of Google's latest foray into the internet browser market. Is there nothing they won't do? And we'll be speaking with Daniel Burka, CTO of news aggregator Dig and co-founder of social network Pounce, about being the gatekeeper of all of the information on the web. So stick around just in case the unexpected does happen. First, they organized our lives. Then they mapped the universe. Next up, they created their own world. Now Google wants to own our internet. Last week, news was leaked that the search giant is planning its own web browser to challenge the might of Microsoft's Internet Explorer and the ever-encroaching open-source alternative, Firefox. When will they stop? Well, we'd like to welcome Jack Schofield, who's had a go on Chrome. Jack, what can you tell us about it?
Ooh, it's quite fast. It's a rather early version. We're on 0.2, which is quite a long way from 1.0. But it seems to work very well. I can't. It's a bit short of features I rather like the ability to do decent organising of your bookmarks. But it seems to be, you know, for a version 0.2 browser, very good indeed.
And what does it look like? I mean, thinking about the latest release of Firefox, that's desperately trying to look like Safari. Does Chrome have this this compulsion as well?
No. It actually has quite an Office Vista look and feel in a kind of pale blue scheme. Otherwise, it's got the strongest resemblance to Opera because it's done the Opera-style thing of putting tabs over the top of the address bar, and also the Opera-style thing of giving you a selection of thumbnails of your most frequently visited sites.
And its relationship, clearly, with all of the other Google apps, has that already been integrated? Because as far as I know, there's going to be a lot of that whole thing with Maps and, you know, the search engine and Gmail, et cetera, et cetera.
Not visible as far as I can see. Doesn't mean it's not there, but it's certainly not obvious. The thing that it does is... run JavaScript very quickly, much more quickly than Internet Explorer. Now, since Google Apps depend on sending you huge quantities of JavaScript, this is very good for Google applications. On the other hand, Firefox is pretty nippy at running JavaScript as well, and I'm sure that one of the things that Google Chrome will do is make every other browser manufacturer get their finger out on speeding up JavaScript.
I believe Apple already has a project called Squirrelfish, which it's going to unveil sometime soonish, which is meant to be a much faster JavaScript person. Though the thing with the Google Chrome is that the JavaScript is all compiled, isn't it, rather than being interpreted, which is quite a feat, I think.
Can I ask about the predictive text in the search bar? Because I think it sort of dips back to your search history and recommends websites and terms that you've used before. How effective is that when you're actually using it?
I turned it off after about 30 seconds.
Oh, dear.
It is the one feature that sends information back to the mothership.
Right.
And as does something called Suggest in the Internet Explorer beta of version 8, i.e. 8 beta 2. If you are used to using Google normally, then you like the fact that you can repeat search as you did earlier just by making small adjustments. And of course, if you're using the Google Suggest, it's influenced by what Google thinks. And I'm actually found that it suits my way of working better to go on what I thought myself.
The way this is being set up is as Google basically trying to chip away at Internet Explorer and Microsoft Share there. What's your take on that?
I find it very hard to believe. Take a look at Internet Explorer 6, which was a stunning browser when it came out. That was in 2001. But it still has something like 25% of the market, which puts it something like 5 percentage points over Firefox. You know, so there is enormous stickiness there, and I suspect that most Windows users are probably going to use Internet Explorer and one other, because there's a limit to how many browsers people are going to want to have on their machines.
Nick Carr, who's a former columnist for Guardian Technology, he had an interesting analysis weekend which was suggesting that what Google is trying to do is to make usage of the internet just far more widespread. They don't particularly care whether people are using Internet Explorer or whether they're using Google Chrome, as long as they're using something and doing it on the internet. Mm. Do you think that might be the right way to think of it? That it's not about killing Microsoft by killing off Internet Explorer. It's about killing Microsoft by getting people not to use Office, not to be doing things on their PC, but to be doing things in the cloud.
Well, certainly it's calculated to make internet applications work better. And so that's a good thing. The other thing is that it's open source. And therefore, the things that Google is doing with Chrome, and bearing in mind it's based on other things that are already out there, like WebKit, that means everybody else can either take the stuff from Google Chrome and use it, or copy it, or do whatever they like. One of the best remarks I ever heard about Microsoft was somebody said they weren't raising the bar, they were raising the floor. So how do you move the entire industry up one or more levels? And I think that Chrome is that kind of operation for Google. It's raising the floor on internet applications by making them more useful.
And that must be a threat to Microsoft, surely?
Well, the bulk of Microsoft's business doesn't come from the web. I mean, it only makes a couple of billion a year. It would like to make more, obviously.
But to continue the metaphor, I mean, is Google not sort of tilting the floor slightly so that, you know, at one end of the room you've got Microsoft with all the money that comes into it, at the other end you have Google, so to speak, and it's tilting the floor so that people run down towards the Google end?
Yeah, but the sales of PCs and Office and, you know, the 10 billion a quarter of whatever it is of server software they sell, they're not going to go away, or not anytime soon. And we had the same thing with IBM. Had Microsoft not arrived and kind of liberated us from, you know, from the mainframe, IBM was on track to be a $200 billion company instead of a $100 billion company. So IBM grew like wildfire to 70 or 80 billion and then it more or less plateaued. So if you look at Microsoft, that is still growing like wildfire. I mean, sales and profits have doubled since Ballmer took over. But it's currently on 50 billion, 60 billion. It might make 70 or 80 billion, but it then may plateau. But that's not the same as going away. It'll still make pots of money just the way IBM does today.
I'd like to bring Jemima in here, actually. Jemima, looking at the launch, effectively what happened was there was a leak of a comic book which explained Chrome that was sent out accidentally to a blogger. That's curious.
Yeah, it was a bit convenient. I mean, the comic book itself was incredibly well written. I hesitate to say even my mum would sort of get the gist of what's going on from reading that. So, you know, if you were sceptical, you could say they did that deliberately. But it was an extremely effective way to launch a new product.
It was picked up by a German blogger, wasn't it? And the suggestion I've heard is that the American folk at Google didn't realise. They'd seen in their calendars that Monday was a holiday. which it was in the US, but not in Europe. And that they sent the things out, figured there wouldn't be a mail delivery or, you know, postal delivery on that Monday. Instead, there was. And this guy said, hey, there's a comic here, and wrote it up.
Final question. Google is... it seems to be throwing a lot of money at a lot of different projects.
Yeah, but this is really key for them. I mean, arguably, this is the only major piece of software that you use every single day that Google has not had a hand in before, and it's surprising they haven't launched anything in the web browser area.
Well, we look forward to poking around with Chrome soon. Thank you very much, Jack, and hopefully when they release a Mac client.
Well, they say they're working on it, a Mac and Linux version, well, so then we'll have to wait and see.
Hopefully we'll be able to play around with it soon. In the meantime, here's Jemima with the latest news stories from the world of technology.
They invented the web and now they're ending the world. The Large Hadron Collider will finally be switched on at CERN this Wednesday, which will either mean we start to learn a huge amount about the structure of physical matter or that the world will start to eat itself from the inside through a series of black holes. Either way, you can follow its progress at guardian.co.uk/science/CERN, and there will also be a Science Weekly podcast on CERN this week. The next generation of super-fast 100 megabit per second broadband could cost the UK up to £28.6 billion, the Broadband Stakeholder Group has advised. A government review is expected to rule against £15 billion of government investment, though BT and Virgin Media are both rolling out limited networks. After the usual weeks of speculation, Apple updated its iPod line with a new shape Nano and the next generation of iTunes, iTunes 8. And a US trade association has written to antitrust regulators opposing the Google and Yahoo advertising alliance. The Association of National Advertisers says the two firms now control 90% of search ads in the US, but the deal does not need regulatory approval.
There's been an incredible amount of technology, like really useful technology, user technology that's come out of CERN. What are we going to see out of the Large Hadron Collider? I mean, obviously, we've had the web. What's in it for us?
We're not really going to see anything with the naked eye, Alex.
Well, what is in it for us? I mean, I'm clearly very excited about it because there's such a buzz.
Well, we understand why we're here and what the minute elements that make up our body are, what's inside.
It's quite existential.
It's very existential that it really gets down into the very, 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 very elementary nature of matter and antimatter and not matter and dark energy, especially, which is one of the things that they think you might be able to find. And in technology terms, the LHC is just... it's like a cathedral to science.
It's really phenomenal.
It has to be so precise. In the building of it, they found where the place where they were digging down to, where they wanted to put some of the big detectors to see what was going on. Because basically what they're doing is reusing an existing particle collider, but they wanted to put some new detectors in. They dug down and they found there were two rivers flowing through where they wanted to go. So they, you know, rather than most people would say, oh, there's a river, they can't do it. They said, okay, it's just a river. We'll freeze it and then we'll build around it.
Oh my God.
They put down two huge pipes filled with brine at -5 centigrade, pumped that through for a few months until the rivers are all starting to get a bit icy. Then they replaced the brine with liquid nitrogen, -196 centigrade, and that freezes the rivers. Having frozen the river, you then go down and put loads of concrete and things.
The environmental impact is profound.
Is that safe?
Brine. And the brine, was there anything living in the river? Is it underground?
Well, if there was, I think they might have. No, not that deep underground. And, you know, it's a long way down in the mountain.
The Evian factory suffering?
That's right. This is the sort of engineering. Wow. This is just to get stuff done.
And of course, I mean, this is out of the same brains, as I mentioned before, from whence the World Wide Web has come. What other technologies have come out of CERN that have been a kind of a sidestep to the actual physical science that they're looking at?
One of the key things that's going to really come out of the whole LHC project is going to be grid computing. They're really doing it in a big, serious way here because the amount of information that comes out of the LHC is vast. You're talking about petabytes of data. And analysing that is not the sort of thing you can get one guy on a wheezing old PC to do. It's really got to throw it among lots of very powerful computers.
Mostly because of the volume of photographs they have of each of the explosions. Mm. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And also analysing it is very difficult because you have to be able to screen things out. Often you have to do the experiments multiple times because you can't be sure that something wasn't just a quirk of Rodney.
Enormous amount of data. That is going to be so exciting. I'm personally very much looking forward to it because I deal with a lot of data and I've been searching for a supercomputer for a long, long time. So I might give them a call. Hi, CERN. Can I do my research? Thanks very much.
That's as long as it doesn't suck the world up.
It's gone. Bye-bye.
Dahlias. Aren't we turning into dahlias? Oh, petunias.
But speaking of...
And a large surprised whale.
Indeed. Speaking of keeping up broadband, what's going on with this broadband thing? Very briefly, Jemima.
Well, okay, we'd like a new generation of Tinterweb, basically, so that we can download a song within seconds and we can download even HD movies really, really quickly. And for that to happen, we need a whole new rollout of much faster fibre optic cable. There has been a government consultation looking at how much this is going to cost and whether it's viable. And it's looking like they're going towards saying it's not, which is kind of mixed. And Francesco Chow, who's a former chief executive of Cable and Wireless, seemed to say that there are other technologies we should be using and we can't put all our eggs in one basket. So there are things like, you know, wireless technologies we should be looking at.
The problem is just that it's so expensive to do and the benefits are so hard to put a number on and they're stretched over such a long period over the future.
How much of this is about keeping up with the Joneses, though? Because you think of the broadband infrastructure in places like Sweden or in places like Korea. Is the government not thinking about this or is it just simply are they thinking about the price tag?
Well, bear in mind, we don't have the outcome of this of Francesco Chow's report yet, but he said he can't see any reason why it would have a negative impact on the competitiveness of the UK market. But I can't imagine a lot of people in the industry agree with that, so we'll just have to wait and see.
Well, you can find out about these stories and a whole lot more at guardian.co.uk/technology. With so much information on the web and only a limited time to browse it, the News Aggregator has proven to be a phenomenally useful service for filtering the information you really want from the ocean of stuff you don't. One of the market leaders in the tech world in particular is Digg. Now, I spoke with Daniel Burka, Digg's CTO, at the recent Deconstruct conference in Brighton, and I began by asking him what makes the site unique in the increasingly crowded market.
Digg's an interesting community because you don't have to be in an explicit social connection with anybody. You know, there's... when we've got a huge registered user base and those people have a lot of social connections, but at the same time we have millions, you know, we have 10 times as many people visit the site who aren't registered, and those people are also benefiting from the community aspect of the website. We've started thinking a lot more when we're doing feature development about what features are actually good for non-registered users.
I want to talk a little bit about how you build reputation and trust, what that system is that you've built, because that's one of the benchmarks and certainly one of the major social currencies online and something that's very, very difficult to do.
The trust within the community is largely based on history. So you could compare it to eBay, perhaps. I kind of see my friends list on Digg as split into two halves. On one hand, I've got friends who are my real-world friends or people I have social interaction with. And then there's other friends who I've found have a reputation on Digg for digging good content that I'm into. So I friend them up so I can follow them. And so that's something we're really trying to tap into with this new recommendation engine feature, is that part of the feature is to recommend people to you, not just content, but people who do similar activities to you. And, you know, if you keep seeing a certain name popping up high on the list with a, you know, an excellent rating, then, you know, you start wondering, like, who is this person? Like, why do we have such similar tastes? But the basic principle is that it looks at what activity you've done, and then it looks for other people who've done similar activities. And then using those people, it recommends stuff that they've done. So, you know, it matches you to people and then matches you to content based on those people. I remember, you know, when I was joined the site, we had maybe 300 or 400 stories a day getting submitted. And that was, you know, you could parse that. Now we've got over 16,000 stories submitted a day. And it's, you know, nobody has the time to go through it. If you refresh the first page of, you know, upcoming, it's just a whole new set of stories. So it's impossible to keep up with, and it's hard for anything to gain momentum naturally. So the original purpose of the recommendation engine was, how can we take that 16,000 stories and boil it down again? I think this is really important because some people have looked at the recommendation engine and they said, well, it's a failure because only 2 out of those 15 stories you showed me are ones I'm into. But the real purpose of this iteration of the recommendation engine was to take those 16,000 stories and find at least a few in there that you'd like.
Isn't there a danger with services like Dig and, say, Yahoo Answers, or any of these services that you as a consumer will only get the information that you want to get?
Somebody described that some online communities look like no real communities they know because it's so homogenous, right? And so I think no matter what we do, and we're very focused on this, that there's going to be very fuzzy edges to a lot of these things.
How are you going to do that, though?
I can envision that if we, took this very far, that it would recommend content to you. But at the same time, if 12,000 people, this is, still a fairly high Dig count, that should be spread to almost everybody. Because one of the attractions to Dig is this idea that I want to know what everybody else is into. An earthquake, for instance. I may not be a scientist and into earthquakes, explicitly, but something of that import should be shared with everybody.
Well, that ties in nicely with my next question. How do you feel about being such an important gatekeeper in this new economy of information, and how it's so free and how it's spread?
That's a bit of an old media opinion, that the gatekeeper. The gatekeeper thing doesn't exist. Anyone of any intelligence has way more than one, news source. Nobody uses Dig as their primary or their sole news source.
You mentioned briefly this afternoon in one of the questions about the relationship with games and what you guys have learned from games in terms of reputation. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Right. Dig itself is something of a game, right? I'd be careful of calling it overly democratic. If you made Dig super fair, we actually wouldn't show you the Dig counts until after you had voted, right? I mean, it's obviously biasing you, knowing how, 10,000 people like that, you give it extra attention and you want to join the crowd and Dig it as well. But that's part of what makes Dig really fun, too. But you have a big enough mass and these things end up generating, reliable results.
And then the last question is, the inevitable. So tell me a bit about some of the new features that you guys are thinking about bringing along.
One project that Mark and I are actually working on, came over and did a workshop with me here, is redesigning the story pages. I think what we want to do is take the idea of the recommendation engine, but apply it to anonymous users as well, right? But what we can also do with it is say that people who like this story also like these stories. CNN might say, people who clicked on this also clicked on that, but that is no indication that people liked it. It just had a catchy title. So we're going to bring up a lot of related content. I think we could do much better with that on the what we call the permalink pages or the story pages.
That was Daniel Burka, CTO at Dig. So what responsibility? We mentioned during the interview this notion of gatekeeping as being an old media concept. But what responsibility do you think that Burka and, for example, Commander Taco at Slashdot, another news aggregating service, what responsibility do you think they have as gatekeepers for the information that then goes out?
Well, I do think the word gatekeeper is quite old school because it implies that they have some kind of control over what you're allowed to access. And that's not really relevant anymore.
On Slashdot, they sort of do, because they decide what goes up, really. I mean, that's in contrast to Dig, where if enough people dig it, then it will rise to the top.
But what's interesting from the interview is that he was talking about how, when he first started, he was going through 600 articles himself to decide what was okay to go up on the site. And now they've got a phenomenal number of items that come that are submitted. And there are still people who go through them and decide what is and what isn't available. So there is still an element of gatekeeping.
There's a question of gaming as well. I mean, that's still an issue for Dig, and it comes up every now and again, people playing the system.
But what is the best way to get a reputation on Dig?
Well, does it have to be just about Dig, though? I mean, I think as soon as you focus just on one system too much, then that's where the problems start, isn't it? I mean, if you have a good profile and you've got a good piece, it should be picked up in a multitude of places. That, there are other products available on the market.
What I find interesting is the question, actually, of how does Matt Drudge of Drudge Report do it? Because that's still one guy, one site, as far as I know.
He's the exception rather than the rule,
well,
I think,
yeah,
Matt
but
Drudge.
But even Matt Drudge, how can he scale? Because I'm sure that the amount of sources that he's got has increased phenomenally
since the whole
Monica Lewinsky and everything.
But the key here with both Dig and Drudge is that they're a filter to the internet. Matt Drudge takes everything and he puts it through his very peculiarly skewed Drudge filter. It's his take on the world and what he sees. And people like, people who are politically inclined the same way as him like his kind of filter, so that's why they go to him. And the same for people that go to The Guardian, they like our voice on the world. And it's the same for stories on Dig, although that's more about, a volume of material. But there's a certain community and characteristics behind that people trust.
What's the difference then between a filter and a gatekeeper?
Because it's not about restricting access to stuff. It's about picking out the stuff that's most relevant.
Gatekeeper to me sounds like somebody lets something, you know, it's like a shepherd. They sort of let something through, something not, something through, something not. Filter, same sort of thing, surely. The difference, of course, being from The Guardian, you know, The Guardian, say, you compare to Matt Rush, which is that The Guardian originates the content. So it's not being a filter or a gatekeeper, except in the sense of it's, because it adds a voice to these things. There's a certain
gatekeeper is often used by news organisations who categorically will not cover a certain kind of news, and I don't think that is the case for Dig. You know, they have a certain personality and a certain style, but it's more about bringing in things that are relevant to them rather than deciding categorically yes or no, because there's such a broad community that decide on that. It's more democratic.
We'll have the entire content of the interview up at guardian.co.uk/audio, but in the meantime, let's hear from you. So what's been going on in Guardian-oriented Web 2.0 land this week, Jemima?
We've had a lot of comments to a piece about the Jerry Seinfeld and Microsoft advert, which a lot of people got very excited about. It was going to be the saviour of Vista. And then we watched it and went, what on earth was that all about? I mean, it didn't even quite work on a sort of...
Was it a sort of advert about nothing, basically?
Well, the two guys were in a shoe shop, and that's pretty much it. I said... Either I'm missing my American humour plug-in, or that's just not funny.
Ah, that was funny.
And Tokyo Nambu said, back in the mid-90s, Apple was a washed-up company who hadn't released a product of any substance in 10 years, beloved of a small and ageing coterie of people who saw themselves as edgy urban hipsters but were, in fact, still living in the 80s but just didn't know it. Rather like, mutatis mutandis, Jerry Seinfeld today.
Ooh.
Ouch.
Handbags of Dawn. Comedy Claws. Mm. Well, over on the games blog, we've been talking about Spore, the new game that that came from Will Wright, who's the creator of The Sims, SimCity, et cetera, and it's had an enormous amount of excitement from the games community. Phenomenal excitement. People have been sort of panting to get their hands, their mitts on this game. And they released, this is an aside, but they released a creature creator, because within the game you can actually create little avatars and they do all types of things.
I've seen them. They're quite cute.
They are very cute. But in internet lore, there's a certain... measurement called time to Willy, which is a nice version of it, also known as TTC. And apparently the TTC in Spore was just under an hour. So that's your audience.
Was there only a TTC?
And can you then reproduce?
Was there a TTT or just...
just a TTC.
Okay.
But the point that I was trying to bring up is that Greg spoke about this and he said, is Spore going to be as good as The Sims? And Tomaszek says, I don't think that Spore will have the same mass appeal as The Sims, but frankly, with all that cash from The Sims, they can afford to release something really good, and to hell with the plebs.
Ooh.
I know, hardcore gamer there. So, Charles, any TTC on yours?
Indeed not. Paul Carr and I, Paul was in the studio a few weeks ago, got into a sort of little tweet meme, which came on from that, there's the famous poem about, and then they came for, you know, this group and took them away, and I said nothing because I wasn't one of that group, and then they came for this group and took them away, and I said nothing, and then they came for me and there was no one to speak for me, which is a very famous poem about, basically, Nazi oppression, but we wondered if we could apply it to the internet, and Paul suggested that it would actually be people who came for Amazon's recommendation engineers also came for. And on the blog, we also had Wowzer808 who said, and then they came for the Wikipedians, but left after just making minor edits. Misplaced apostrophe.
Citation needed.
Jolien Rossi. And then they came for the capture developers, but couldn't work out if that last splodge was an M, a W, or possibly a T. And Fred 2 finally. And then they came for the people who come for people, but discovered that coming for people recursively is too geeky by far.
Hey, well done. Well, on our Facebook group, we've broken the 600 mark on members. Hurrah!
Come on.
Hooray for us.
Get on.
I know. Also on the wall, Richard Garside has kindly offered a suggestion about where to find papercraft information, because I mentioned papercraft during my talk at Deconstruct in Brighton, which is richardsprojects.co.uk/origami. Sam Saunders has sent in our email suggestion of the week to tech@guardian.co.uk. He's a big gaming fan and humbly requests that Bobby, who is now based in San Francisco, he asked Bobby to interview the guys from gaming site IGN. So keep listening, Sam. He may just do that if we ask him nicely.
Has anyone actually heard from Bobby?
No.
Is he? I think he maybe landed.
I think that they've landed, yes.
I think he's been eaten by the glamorous parties.
Yeah. He hasn't tweeted. By the way, have you heard there's a new microblogging system for people in gyms? Fitter.
Oh, no!
Oh, God.
Look at him, he's laughing so hard.
There's one for
he's giggling.
Yeah, no.
Go on.
There's one for moths who've just discovered a light in the ceiling.
Flutter.
Yeah.
Hey!
No!
And for people from Germany who happen to be very polite, bitter.
Oh, no, please get in touch in other ways, not this way. But you can get in touch with us via the blogs or email, Charles's Twitter feed, apparently, and even our Flickr pool. Check it out, Guardian Tech Weekly, for the latest snaps of our team and the people that we stalk. That's all, folks. I'm off to the Sirius Virtual Worlds Conference in Coventry later this week, and to the Web 2 Expo on the Web Mission in New York next week. Jemima, do you have anything planned?
Yes, interviewing Brent Hoberman, lastminute.com founder, and now running MyDeco at a conference on Wednesday.
You should point that camera at yourself.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, hi.
You can see the results on our Flickr site.
I'm sure there's lots of other things, but we just don't know yet.
Charles, your turn for the camera.
I'm going to be sweeping up all the fallout from the Apple announcements, and I'm going to be up to my elbows editing a special section for the technology section for September the 18th, which is going to be the 100 top clean technology companies.
Ooh, that sounds good.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be continuing to flip lots of things.
Yes, that's exactly what Jemima's doing right now. If you want to see the video using Jemima's flip, you can at our Flickr site, which is Guardian Tech Weekly. Please stop. Stop now. You're making me nervous. Oh, yes, Jemima, you wanted to mention your bat holder phone.
I got a bat rest in the post today. It looks like something Batman might sort of clean his teeth with. It's like a sort of small...
It's the bat brush.
Yeah, smaller than a credit card, sort of folds in half, and it's a piece of plastic you put on a table, and then you put your iPhone on it, and you play videos.
Well,
so that it's at the right angle.
We've got pictures on the site.
Yeah.
It's our caption competition this week. Come up with your best suggestion. We've already thought of,
you've used a
Batman logo.
Rhinoplasty. Some sort of Salvador Dali's moustache.
That was quite funny. And you were doing some Groucho Marx impressions. But anyway, we've got some to give away.
Man is as young as a woman he feels. Ha ha.
Go to our Flickr group and throw your caption up there. But while I'm gone in New York, the podcast will still keep podding. So catch up with us next Tuesday. Until then, thanks to Daniel Burke from Dig. And as always, to our in-house team, Jemima Kish and Charles Arthur. They shall see you next Tuesday.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.